So I, when I was asked to do this, I actually did not hear what David now said, that I was supposed to somehow summarize, you know, the nanoscience field and where is it heading. So this will just be my own view of the things which I find interesting, and I don't think this is really representative for the field as a whole. I've been rather motivated by actually a book which one of the authors is here. It's called The Mesoscopic Quantum Optics. And I think this is, at least from my personal point of view of what I want to be doing in the next couple of years, this is really what I want to do. And I've been studying quantum optics in the last couple of years, just like a student, because I didn't know anything about it. And one of the things which I learned from that is that, I mean, these guys are, of course, very, very sophisticated, but they don't know anything about disorder. They don't know, well, very little, I guess, about chaotic scattering. And these are all notions which in the field of mesoscopic physics, nanophysics, are really very important. So I see a lot of nice, you know, ways to do things which might perhaps even be useful. So I this will really be a blackboard thing as announced, but I have one or two slides just to show some pictures of. This is actually the experiment which What do I do to focus on? Should I turn on this thing here? Okay. So this was actually the experiment which got me started. It's 2 years old by now. It's by Hui Cao and her group at Northwestern University. And this is actually the realization, the experimental realization of something which was proposed long ago in the 1960s. By famous Russian physicist called Letohov. Perhaps you've never heard of him, but he's a Nobel class type of physicist, who realized that actually the usual way to make a laser, which is, you know, you have two mirrors and have the light bounce back and forth between them, is not really needed. And he postulated or invented this thing which now has a much nicer name. It's now called the random laser. See, for a laser, you need basically two things. You need amplification, that's provided by some population inversion, so you have to somehow bump it, various ways of doing that. And then you need feedback. And the feedback typically is provided by mirrors. That's how the laser in your CD works. So that's a nice, clean system, no disorder. But Letohov actually, you know, hypothesized that there might be lasers up there in the sky, in stellar atmospheres, where population inversion is generated by some chemical reaction, and where the feedback, no big mirrors up there, so the feedback is just provided by gases, so by multiple scattering, which is of course a disordered medium, but which could be very effective at providing the feedback you need for a laser. So this was this idea that there might be some laser action in astrophysics. I know very little about that, but I know it's a big field. There's a big literature. And what Cao did is actually realize that in a laboratory. So she used some powder, some semiconductor zinc oxide powder. It's a very strongly scattering powder. It's also been used to try to observe Anderson localization of light, which, as you know, is also one of these big issues, still an open problem. And she pumped it, and you see here the luminescence line width, which for low pumping strength is just some broad thing. And then as you increase the pumping strength, a narrow spike appears somewhere here, which is the signature of a laser. And as you increase the pumping strength further, there are more spikes, so it's, you could say, a multi-mode laser. You don't really know before where the spikes will appear. I mean, if you somehow shake the powder and do the experiment again, they will appear at a different place. The idea being, as it's somehow shown schematically here, the idea being that you can imagine some sort of virtual cavities in this strongly scattering medium, and there will be one cavity which will have the most effective. And so the photons will be locked up there for pretty long, and that will be the first one to start lasing. But then these wave functions, they might not overlap with some other region, and so this other region might then get a chance to start lasing a little bit later. And so there's actually some nice problems which you could start to ask. If you look at this, for example, what is the density of these peaks? Very, very non-trivial question. How many peaks per frequency interval can you expect statistically? Will they show perhaps some sort of repulsion? Whole variety of questions. But these are actually not the questions which I'd like to discuss today, because today I want to talk to you about quantum optics. And as you probably know, to describe a laser is entirely a problem in classical optics. You can just write down a wave equation. Blackboard lunch needs chalk. Yeah, they're only colored pieces. Shall I use colored pieces? Well, okay, I use a colored piece. So if you write down the wave equation, right? Say some electric field. That's the wave equation. And if you want to describe stimulated emission, which is what you need to describe a laser, then all you have to do is give this epsilon here, an imaginary part. If the imaginary part is positive, then you have stimulated emission. It's as easy as that. So stimulated emission is for the light is an entirely classical process. You can just describe it in a classical wave equation. And that is also what Lithokhov did and what has been done quite extensively also following this work. Okay. Now, to ask about quantum optics is, of course, not to look at stimulated emission, it's to look at spontaneous emission. So there will be some noise, some fluctuations, and these fluctuations are, I think, interesting. And you could ask a question, so how does this random laser differ in its fluctuations from, say, a conventional laser? Fluctuations, they probably would show up here in this wave equation as some right-hand side, some fluctuating source term. You could try to perhaps do that somehow phenomenologically, and this has also been done, some sort of Langevin equation. And you could possibly get quite far with that. But my strategy here was somehow different. You see, we as condensed matter physicists, we are really good at treating disorder. Right? We have a whole bunch of tricks, a whole bunch of techniques, perturbative techniques, diagrammatic techniques, non-perturbative techniques, field theories, my own favorite, which is random matrix theory. And then I would actually like to somehow cast the quantum optical problem in a language that I could just use this bag of techniques. And you know, and give it to students and say, look, this is the technique, this is the problem, it's not been studied before, you know what to do. So I somehow wanted to cast the problem of statistics of photons by some medium which is amplifying and disordered in a language where I could use the techniques from condensed matter theory. This is actually how also the relation between, say, mesoscopic physics and classical optics proceeded. As you know, there's been a very fruitful interchange between the two, basically using the fact that this equation here looks, of course, very similar to the Schrödinger equation. But this will be the Schrödinger equation. They're really similar. And then, so this analogy has been used quite extensively in their effects like weak localization, which have a counterpart in optics. It's called coherent backscattering. There's localization, strong localization, which is now being searched for. So this analogy was used quite extensively in people who have one bag of techniques that have been applied first to optics or to electronics. So I wanted to do the same thing for an equation which would have a fluctuating right-hand side, which of course here doesn't quite exist, right? There's nothing like a fluctuating source which will generate electrons. And I needed a way to formulate it in that way. That's actually what I would like to discuss for you today. And so perhaps, I had to figure out the answer for myself, but perhaps you say it's obvious, and I would know how to do that, and that's quite possible. So, but before I do that, let me go back a little bit and teach you something about black body radiation. I knew very little about black body radiation, so perhaps you say, look, this is pretty silly, right? And then you just shout and I'll shut up. But I thought actually it's a great topic, and I'll use that to kind of formulate the kind of questions which I want to address. So black body radiation . So that's somehow a simpler problem. I would like to study the statistics generated by this amplifying medium. Black body radiation is statistics of photons generated by a completely absorbing medium. Right, some object here. Small hole. Light comes out. and this thing is somehow black, so that every photon which comes in is completely absorbed before it gets out. And you have some photodetector here, written usually like this. So this counts photons. Suppose it counts n photons in a time t. It does that, let's make it simple, in some frequency interval. Assume that you have some monochromator or some nice frequency resolution. So delta omega is the frequency window in which you're counting them. And the question is, what is p of n? What is it? First answer would be very naive, say, look, this is like just like radioactivity. These photons just come out independently, one at a time. And so then I would guess that this might be a Poisson distribution, right? Poisson statistics. So that would be 1 over n factorial times e to the minus times n bar, the mean to the power n, times e to the minus n bar. Right? That's Poisson distribution, which means that these photons are like independent particles. And this is actually a fantastically good approximation for black body radiation. In fact, even if you make the temperature of this black body very, very high, like the surface of the sun, it's within 1 part in 10^4 it's described by a Poisson distribution. So photons really do behave like independent particles, but not quite, of course. We know that they're bosons, so they somehow like to have some sort of statistical attraction. And so this is not really correct. And this problem, what's the correct distribution, was first solved by Einstein. He solved basically every problem, right? There's this issue on nanoscience, which is here in the corridor, which has this timeline, the giants of nanoscience. I'll mention just the first two entries, I guess. First entry, number one, says 400 billion years ago, Mother Nature creates the cell. That's the first entry. No, actually, there are three nice entries. That's the first entry. Second entry is Democritus coins the word atom, say several hundred BC. And then comes the third entry, and that's Einstein measures the sign or infers the sign of a molecule by using his theory for Brownian motion. So he was the giant of that field. He's also the giant of, you could say, quantum optics or black body radiation. He was the first to figure out what this distribution was. It has a very simple form. There is, of course, something like e to the minus h bar omega over kt. This black body has a certain temperature, T, so a certain frequency, omega. So to have quanta at that frequency will cost a certain energy, e to the minus n h bar omega over kt. And then there is a combinatorial coefficient here, n plus nu minus 1 over n, where nu is a number. It is T times delta omega over 2 pi. And actually, you may multiply this, because you can imagine if my photodetector is bigger, then it will collect more photons. So you can multiply this by a number which is proportional to the area of the photodetector. I call it n. That's just a number of channels, number of waveguide modes which this photodetector can absorb. It's the same number n which would appear, say, if you would calculate the conductance of a certain object. So this is this number n. It's up to a numerical coefficient. It's the area of the photodetector divided by the wavelength squared. And then there is a numerical geometrical coefficient, which depends on whether it's square or circular. So this distribution here is has a name. It's called the it's the black body distribution, but it has also, say, in the mathematical literature, a name. It's called the negative binomial distribution. You can understand it quite easy. This coefficient here, so this number nu, okay, is also a name. This is called the number of degrees of freedom. You should imagine it like this. You have, I mean, we're used to having cells in phase space, right? A cell in phase space which has an area of h. Now here we are somehow a bit more vague. We're in time, but I can imagine this timeline and divide that into cells. And then the length of this cell is 1 over delta omega. So this number nu is how many independent cells I have in this interval t during which I'm measuring, counting the photons. So that's, and for this distribution, it's called the number of degrees of freedom. This combinatorial coefficient just tells you how many ways there are to put n bosons and particles into nu boxes. these new cells in phase space. I have n bosons. There can be more than one particle in each box, and this is the number of ways to do that. So nobody's asking any questions, so let me just ask you something just to show you, see if you're still awake. Why is it called negative binomial negative binomial coefficient? This coefficient is called the negative binomial coefficient. We know about binomial coefficients, right? Know about binomial coefficients? Yes? So why is this called the negative binomial coefficient? Yeah, that's true. It is, so a binomial coefficient is if you take, say, 1 plus x to the power nu, right? And then the coefficient in terms of x to the n is nu over n. And if you take this, then the coefficient in terms of x to the n is this number here. Oh, the other minus here. So it's what if you take a power series with an inverse power. In fact, you can see that this series here terminates, this series here does not terminate, and indeed this coefficient, you can take n as big as you want, it will never terminate. That's just why it's called negative binomial distribution. Okay, so that's the complete solution, actually. There's nothing else to say about black body radiation, except for this one point, which I already mentioned, that in a... So, okay, let me just look at moments. There's one more thing which I want to tell you. Let's look at moments. So the first moment is m bar. Okay, that's not particularly interesting. The variance, that's interesting. Let's write it up here. So the variance of n is n bar. That's actually, both these have, of course, n bar. That's just what you get for a Poisson process, variance equal to the mean. And then there is a correction, 1 plus nu over n bar. No, 1 plus n bar over nu. And so this correction, which was found by Einstein, is the correction due to the fact that we are talking about bosons. So the variance is a little bit bigger than what you would get for independent particles. It's bigger by a factor 1 plus n bar over nu. And this n bar over nu is very, very small. In fact, n bar over nu is, for a black body, it's basically e to the minus h bar omega over kt. In fact, I can be more precise here. It is just the Bose-Einstein function. Okay, so this is this ratio n bar over nu. That's this Bose-Einstein function. It's the occupation of a mode. And it's a very small number. That's why black body radiation is very well described by a Poisson distribution. But now, of course, it can become interesting if we talk about a laser. We know that the laser has a very high occupation. It's not described by this equilibrium distribution. There's a very high occupation. And so you can get large deviations from Poisson statistics. And then you can ask, okay, how are these deviations? What law describes these deviations? Is it still something of this form? Perhaps with another number nu? Actually, for a conventional laser, that's indeed what happens. I mean, the variance is still described by this form here, where instead of putting this function here, we just take a negative temperature. We'll come back to that, but you may have already come across that a laser can be described by a system in thermal equilibrium at negative temperature. But the idea is pretty obvious. I mean, you would say if this says this is the occupation number, if say you have here, everything is occupied and one might be excited, that's positive temperature, whereas for a laser, you would typically have the opposite, right? They would all be occupied, the atomic levels would all be occupied here, and then perhaps there might be one down. So it looks as if the temperature has been inverted. So that's actually what happens with a conventional laser. You can just use this Einstein's formula, and then all you have to do is take the temperature to be negative. So that's kind of simple. And now the question is, what happens for a random laser? Is it still this simple thing, or is the randomness going to do something interesting? Okay, so that's the problem. I've told you the experiment, I've told you the problem. Now I'll tell you the solution. Right? And so do ask me any questions if you want to, right? I mean, it's basically, I don't have a lot to say, so don't worry that I'll somehow go over your...
So even for this regular laser, not random, negative temperature means that this mu is negative?
Yeah, okay, so that's right. So indeed, if you take T, so let's call this F, right? If you take T goes to zero from below, then F goes to minus one. So probably I would have to take the absolute value of that. I'm just telling you some sort of vague things. I'll be much more precise, of course, in what follows. But it's true. If you take a negative temperature, then somehow there will be, have to be a minus sign somewhere else to get something. And okay, because f goes to minus 1. Okay, now, so this is the problem. The problem is the same, but now I want to phrase it in a much more general way. Instead of saying that it's a black body, I'm just going to say that this object, which I've erased here, is just some object. Could be anything. Some absorbing medium, which is not a black body, an amplifying medium, which is not a black body. I want to do it in the most general way, and I hope that I find a route which will bring me to something which I can solve using the toolbox of a condensed matter theorist. Okay, that's my goal. I'm sure there are very many ways to solve this problem, but I want a route which brings me to something which I can use. And that route, I didn't know of that route, so I had to think of it myself. Let me just show you what I did. So the first thing is I read this book on quantum optics, and I found a formula due to Glauber. I mean, basically everything goes back to Glauber, right? When we talk about photon statistics, Glauber, 1963, who said, very general formula for what P of n is. P of n is an expectation value of, well, something which looks like, this is still my n factorial. So this looks like a Poisson distribution, right? But instead of having n bar here, I have n operator. So this n here is this n. That's just a variable, 1, 2, 3, 4. But there is this operator n bar, n hat. And there's an expectation value. So that's somehow, it looks as if the correct way to treat the problem is to do as if you have a Poisson distribution, but instead of having a fixed mean, there are quantum fluctuations in the mean. Because this is an operator, so it cannot really be represented by its mean. There are quantum fluctuations. Now, there's one other little piece of technical ingredient here, which is actually quite important. So first of all, what is this n hat? This n hat will typically be something like a dagger a. Actually, to be more precise, it will be something like 0 to t dt prime, where this a is some creation operator, annihilation operator, of the photons as they reach this photodetector. So there's radiation coming, hitting this photodetector. This radiation is described by, typically you would say something like the electric field. It's like A plus A dagger. So you decompose this into creation annihilation operators, and these are the ones which you put here. Now there's one thing which is rather crucial in how a photodetector operates, is that if you're in vacuum, there are vacuum fluctuations, but the photodetector cannot see them. For obvious reasons, because these vacuum fluctuations, you cannot absorb them, and you would be somehow, you know, subtracting photons from the vacuum, which is impossible. And if you would just put in this formula in here, you see there's this exponents, you would get all kinds of mixtures of A's and A daggers, and it would not work out, right? And the correct recipe is that you take normal ordering, so you push all the A's to the right, all the A daggers to the left, so that, okay. Of course, it follows from little theory, which I'm not going to tell you because it's just basic textbook material. But it's a formula which, if you look at it, it kind of makes sense. There's one other piece of bit historical thing which I also found very instructive. Actually, before Glauber derived this formula in 1963, it was guessed by Mandel. Mandel, also one of the pioneers of quantum optics, died just this year. And Mandel guessed this formula right? I mean, Mandel had a more intuitive way of looking at it. He said, okay, there are these fluctuations in this mean. Perhaps these fluctuations are described by some probability distribution, and I have to average over this probability distribution. Right? And actually, that way he arrived at the fact that the laser, a true good laser, has simply Poisson statistics, because a laser has a very stabilized intensity, so this P of I would be just a delta function, and then you would find the Poisson distribution. And you see, they look pretty much the same, and you can ask, are they actually equivalent? Is this just an intuitive way to derive something which was then rigorously done by Glauber? And the answer is almost, but not quite. Actually, what happens is that certain states of the radiation can only be described by P of I, which can take on negative values. So if you insist on using this formula here, of course you can always do that, but then this P of I does not have the obvious meaning of a probability distribution. It can take on negative values. And a famous example is squeezed radiation. The squeezed radiation is described by a P of I, which can become negative, which is pretty strange. Okay, that's this thing. That's first ingredients. There are just one or two more ingredients, and then we're done. So don't worry, we'll get there. Okay, let me just erase this one. I'm not going to need that. So what is this A? I'm going to write here A out. These are the operators of the radiation which is coming out of this medium, this black body or this random laser, and hitting the photodetector. And somehow I'd have to solve the wave equation to get these, but I want to do it in a way where I can come into familiar grounds. So I'm going to write this, A out is scattering matrix times A in. That's very familiar from scopic physics, transport physics, right? A scattering formulation is great. Something comes out, something comes in. That's how I can derive the Landauer formula or all kinds of other beautiful results. But of course, this is not the whole story. This S here is just a property from classical optics, right? How do you get this S, the scattering matrix? You get this by solving a classical wave equation, which may or may not be difficult, but it's a problem which we're very familiar with. You can put it on a computer, discretize it, and calculate. But what this tells you is that if nothing comes in, then nothing comes out. And we know that's not true, right? I mean, certainly a black body is something which radiates even without shining anything on it. So there are these fluctuations. That was this right-hand side of this, okay, I've erased the equation. It was the right-hand side of this wave equation, right? The fluctuating right-hand side, these fluctuations. And so I have to add something here corresponding to this fluctuating Langevin type of right-hand side. What could it be? I'm going to write something very general because I don't quite know what it is. I'm going to write that U times B plus B times C dagger. Okay, this is just something, but what do I mean by this? U and V are just matrices, like the scattering matrices which contain C numbers. So they're not operators. These are the operators. And to define this, to make sense of this, I assume that all the operators satisfy bosonic commutation relations. Of course, I could also call this by another name, and then it would not. But let me extract a matrix U, which I don't yet know, such that all these operators satisfy bosonic commutation relations. So for every operator, A dagger A is 1. This holds for this one, for this one, for this one, for this one. Okay, so I do that, and they don't commute. This is 0, and also commutators of this one with this one or with this one, they're all 0. So now you just plug that in, and out comes this result. No idea what they do. Photons, so certainly photons, but they're somehow intrinsic to the medium. They're put here to make sure that even if nothing, so imagine this black body, right, this lamp or whatever, nothing's coming in from the outside, still light is coming out. So evidently there are some atomic processes inside which generate photons. No idea how they do that, and I hopefully will not need to put that in, because that will make life very hard, but they do it somehow. Something comes out, and this is somehow degrees of freedom internal to the medium. And this is, say, the most general way to write that down, and the hope, of course, is that now you can do something useful with this equation without having to put in microscopic details, because if we need microscopic details, then we're somehow stuck, because then we cannot make this mapping. I mean, the whole idea of being able to map a problem onto another field is that basically the details don't matter, right? That you have some. Okay, fortunately it works out, because you just plug in this equation here and just a tiny bit of algebra, and what you find is that there's a relation between this U and the V and the S, which is just U dagger minus P V dagger is 1, S is dagger. And that's pretty good. You could call this a fluctuation-dissipation relation. Because if you look at the right-hand side, I mean, if the photons are not absorbed or not created, nothing happens to the photons, then S is a unitary matrix. So 1 minus S is dagger is 0. So then there are no fluctuations. So if there's no dissipation, then there are no fluctuations. On the other hand, if there are fluctuations, then there's dissipation. And now you can also see that if I take this, if there's absorption, then SS dagger is subunitary, so the right-hand side is positive. So then this should be absent, right? Because this is a positive definite matrix. So this is what gives you absorption. And if there is gain, if there's amplification, then this is a superunitary matrix, so this is negative, so then I need this one. So this is what gives you gain. And that's pretty much it. And that's the miracle which happens. So even though we have this new physics in the problem, this new physics of spontaneous emission, which is not present in the Schrodinger equation, it's not present in all these condensed matter problems. And so you might say, well, I have to then, come up with a whole new framework. The answer is no, because of this relationship here. Everything you need to know about stimulated emission can just be extracted from the classical scattering matrix, and can just be extracted from the classical wave equation. And that's wonderful because, the classical wave equation looks very similar to the Schrodinger equation, so I can just use my whole bag of techniques. And I've not invented this relation. I mean, right? But I was particularly pleased when I noticed it, right? I've not invented it, of course, but it's particularly, it's exactly what we need in this problem, because now we're basically done.
I didn't really see clearly what assumptions you put in to get the results in the box.
Okay, the assumptions are this equation and this equation, where for A you can put in any operator, B or C or whatever. Okay, now you just take, say, one, it's A out, excuse me? No, this has nothing yet. I mean, the Glauber formula is what tells me what I want to calculate. Okay, this equation here tells me this is what I want to calculate. And now I have to somehow write that in a way that I can calculate something, right? And this does it because I have these A outs are in terms of the ins, b's, and c's. I know all the commutation relations. And I'm with this. Okay, there's one more ingredient we're not yet done because I've not yet taught you how to do expectation values. But that's really simple. Expectation values are like this. Expectation values are like this. That if you take, for example, this B dagger B, that's just this function f. So I'm assuming that this medium, this black body or this laser or whatever, well, if it's a black body or some absorbing medium, I can say that it's in thermal equilibrium. And then this is almost by definition true. And if it's a laser, I'm using this old device of describing a laser by a medium which is in fictitious equilibrium at negative temperature. So I will use the same formula with the operator C, and you will have an F at negative temperature. So that's it, and that's the whole thing.
So the equation value of the C's
are,
is the equal negative?
Yeah, the C's are.
Still, it's not entirely obvious to me. We have a non-equilibrium situation, so we excite somehow this system.
Yes,
and
yes,
then
yes.
That's lazy.
Yeah.
Somehow we still have fluctuation dissipation theorem. We can separate the fluctuation from.
Let me. So there's one crucial thing here which limits me, and that will actually limit me throughout the talk. So you say I have not done what I promised to do. Is I can only do this below the laser threshold. Right? So if you have an amplifying system, you start amplifying it. All kinds of, I haven't given you the results yet. I'll show you the results. All kinds of interesting stuff happen with the statistics of these photons. Then you reach the laser threshold. That's when you cannot no longer work with a linear wave equation. You have to treat the saturation, all the non-linearities come into play. And there's some ways to go beyond the laser threshold, but not in this formalism here. So this is a linear theory. It's the same pretty much like, when we talk about mesoscopic electron transport. If you're nonlinear response, then everything's beautiful. And if you really want to do nonlinear response, then okay. So everything here is a linear theory, so this will be valid in a laser below the laser threshold. Now you might say, I don't buy this whole stuff about negative temperature. And then all I can say is, well, you know, this is what these guys have been doing for 30 years, and I certainly am not in the position to say anything intelligent about that. I mean, this is what they do, and I would say it works, and it looks pretty reasonable to me. But if you're, you know, a more precise type of person, then you might want to ask about the foundations of this, and there's very little I can say there. Okay. So at what stage are we now? I've basically told you what I want to calculate. And I've told you exactly how to calculate it, right? Because now you just substitute this in here. A in will be assumed to be in the vacuum state, so there will be no radiation coming in. I have these operators here, which are given by this formula here. So now it's just a question of you know, filling in, taking a piece of paper, writing down the formulas, and doing the algebra, and you're done. Right? And I'm not going to show that here, because there's nothing to show, actually. And I'll just give you the result. And the result, I think, is really neat.
Why did you say that it's dissipation theory is different? It's just the number of in channels equals to the number of out channels.
No, if you have no dissipation, I mean absorption or amplification. Right? Okay, let's first talk about the absorbing case. Perhaps you might say amplification is not dissipation. Okay, suppose I have an absorbing problem. Right? Then if photons are absorbed, I call it dissipation. Okay.
But in this relation, there are no amplification numbers.
Let me say it once again. In an absorbing system, I call dissipation if something is absorbed. If something is absorbed, then the scattering matrix is not unitary. Right? So then the right-hand side is non-zero, and then there is a relation which relates the non-zero amount of deviations from unitarity because of dissipation to the amount of fluctuations. But you know, if you don't like this, this is actually a word which I think is quite common in this context, but of course there's nothing, if you don't like it, don't use it. But what is interesting is to look at this formula and notice that there's just no absorption and no gains. We have a conserving system. Then there are also no fluctuations, which, you know, kind of makes sense, because where do these fluctuations come from? They come from the fact that this absorption is only on average described by some dielectric constant. I mean, sometimes an atom will make a transition, sometimes it will not make a transition. There are fluctuations in this, right? So there is some real physics here. The average is described by the scattering matrix, but there are fluctuations because an atom will stochastically absorb a photon or not. Okay, so now let me give you the results. I guess I still have a little bit of time. And the results are basically that I want to know this, right? I want to know P of n. I can give you the full formula, but that's not very illuminating. I'll give you a general equation for all the moments, which is just easier to write down. The general equation for all the moments is that, say, the peak moment is given by, there will be this function here, f to the power p, no surprise here. There will be this number nu. So this will be t delta omega over 2 pi. And then there will be the trace of 1 minus s stagger to the power p. I have to say one more thing, which you may also forget if you want to forget it. There's also a p minus 1 factorial in front. It's also important. I said this is the pth moment. It's not entirely true. It's the pth factorial moment. It's actually the pth. So kp is the pth factorial cumulant, okay, moments or cumulants, that's I guess everybody knows about that. Factorial moments versus ordinary moments. You see, ordinary moments are very convenient if you're talking about Gaussian distributions and deviations from that. Because a Gaussian will have the first two cumulants non-zero and all other cumulants will be zero. Well, here we're talking about deviations from Poisson distribution. And then to talk about moments is not particularly useful, because the Poisson distribution also has all cumulants unequal to zero. So then these people in quantum optics came up with this other thing, which they call factorial moments, or factorial cumulants, which are designed such that they are zero for a Poisson distribution, and so then if they're non-zero, you measure little deviations. And they're just defined in the following way, that if you say want to calculate the pth moment, instead of doing n to the power p, you actually do n times n minus 1 times n minus 2 times n minus p plus 1. So the law of multiplication is to take factorials, right? So let me give you just a simple example. What is K2? K2 is the second factorial cumulant. So K2 is it's just the ordinary variance. Okay, let me, what is it? So it's the average of n times n minus 1 minus the average of n squared. Right? Without the minus 1, that will be the ordinary second cumulant, the ordinary cumulant. But with the n minus 1, it's the factorial cumulant. So this is so the variance of n, that's n bar plus kappa 2. Okay, this is just the most economic way to write it, and this is also what's very common in quantum optics. Now, this formula here looks pretty neat. If you take p equals to 1, then it's actually a known result. So if you take p equals to 1, you get that the mean is t delta omega over 2 pi times f times the trace of 1 minus s is dagger. This is a known result. This is known as Kirchhoff's law, ancient result. Kirchhoff's law basically tells you that if something is a very good absorber, then it's also a very good emitter. Right? So because how do you, it's typically designed in the context of black body radiation. So how do you get what is a black body actually in this language? What's the scattering matrix of a black body? Complicated. Calculate it. What's the scattering matrix of a black body? Zero. Right? Black body is something which you shoot something in and it doesn't come out. I mean, some other photon will eventually come out, but that photon does not come out. So black body matrix has scattering matrix zero, and that gives you the highest possible rate of photon emission. So Kirchhoff's law tells you things which absorb very well also radiate very well. That's a very useful law. And here it's written in this way. It holds actually also for amplifying media. In an amplifying medium, 1 minus s is dagger is negative, of course, but then mercifully this f is negative. And so these two minus sign cancel. Remember that I told you that there was going to be this minus sign which had to be cancelled? So this is how it works. So that this f appears to the pth power, but there's also this 1 minus s is bigger. And this, you can see, is a very natural generalization of Kirchhoff's law to higher cumulants. Perhaps you could have guessed it. Who knows? It looks in a really, if you know this one, then how do you make higher cumulants? Put a p up here, you're done. So it looks... It makes a lot of sense, and it's correct. I'm convinced it's correct. And it has some very striking and unusual implications. Let me show you them. So now we're at the level... Okay, this is basically how far you can go without calculating anything, right? Without telling something about the system which you're studying. This is the most general formula. I like to compare it somehow to something like the Landauer formula, right? Where you say the conductance is traced to t dagger. It's also the most general formula, and then you're going to use it in all kinds of different applications. And what I like particularly about this result, that it's in terms of the scattering matrix. I told you already that my favorite hobby, my favorite bag of tools, was random matrix theory. So, perhaps somebody else would be happy if he saw it written in terms of some field operator, in terms of a Green's function. For me, I'm delighted if I have some object which is written in terms of a matrix. Because then I can ask, okay, perhaps this matrix is random. And out comes chaos. I haven't said anything actually about chaos yet, right? Because I guess you guys are all experts on chaos. So chaos is mostly canonically described in terms of the scattering matrix.
Your general assumptions, you didn't make the assumption of, let's call it, microscopic reversibility.
I didn't assume anything.
Absorption are related.
Well, I guess if you somehow break things which are really fundamental, all this will break down too. But
doesn't have time reverse in assumptions?
Or? Certainly not the time reverse. I mean, you can apply a magnetic field if somehow you could do that, or some magneto-optical effect. So this is so everything which you can use the magneto-optical effect, have a scattering matrix which is not symmetric, perfectly okay. Okay, let me tell you now, I'm approaching the end, but let me just say one or two things about chaos, which is actually all I need. Chaos is actually the most beautiful system to have a to talk about if you want to study the scattering matrix, because the probability distribution of the scattering matrix for a chaotic system is just a constant. That's, I mean, what easier can you get than that, right? So if I take some chaotic object, say some billiard or some strongly disordered system, so that the light, which is reflected back in a very random way, most random way, then the probability distribution of the scattering matrix is the most random distribution which you can imagine, and that's just a constant distribution. Of course, constant in a particular sense, I mean, this is a matrix, so it's constant in the sense of integrating over a group. It's constant in, that's right, it's constant in the group of n by n unitary matrices. Within this matrix, within this space, it's constant. So actually integrating with this constant is actually highly non-trivial. I mean, because you somehow have to integrate over a group, right? And we've devised a lot of techniques how to do that, and some of these techniques actually also come from my energy physics, where integrating over groups is also useful. So, but this is certainly, to write it down, it's very easy. So what am I going to do? Suppose I want to calculate some mean of this kappa, right? The mean of kappa p. I'm going to, this is a trace, right, but it only depends on the eigenvalues. So what I need, let me just write a proportionality. I'm going to integrate over eigenvalue sigma, so sigma is an eigenvalue of S as dagger, right? S as dagger is a Hermitian matrix. This product is Hermitian, so these are real numbers. So they have some distribution rho, which I can hopefully extract from this guy, and I'm going to calculate this integral, right? That's what I'm going to do. Once I know the distribution of these eigenvalues, then I'm going to calculate this integral, and that will tell me the mean of this factorial cumulus. Now, this is something where I'm then very much at home, because I know how to go from here to here. I mean, that's this bag of tools which has been developed in the last 5 years or so. So we know how to go from here to here, basically by integrating our degrees of freedom, right? But okay, that's what you have to do.
This is not unitary.
It's unitary symmetric. It's a subset of the unitary group. That's right. Okay. No, excuse me. I'm somehow. Yeah, I see. I look at the clock, so I somehow jump ahead of me. Okay. Let me just give you one extra thing here. That's right. S is not unitary, because if it would be unitary, all these S's, all these sigmas would be one, and this integral would be absolutely trivial. So I need how to modify this to include absorption or amplification. I know how to do that. I know how to generalize this to a chaotic system which is absorbing or amplifying. I'm not sure that I'm going to tell you, but if you ask me, either now or in a couple of minutes, I will tell you. It's really simple. But so I know how to modify this constant to include absorption or amplification. And that's what I do. So let me just give you the results, and then I shut up, and then you can still ask me anything you want. Okay? So I think I actually have a slide for that, because that's easier. I have two slides. One slide is just to show you that there's really, in the end, some calculation, right? This is rho of sigma for an amplifying medium. You see they are bigger than one. The matrix S is super unitary, so the eigenvalues of S as dagger are bigger than one. And this gamma is the ratio of the time a photon spends inside this medium to the amplification time. So basically, if gamma is one, then you would have a system which would start lasing. Right? So the laser threshold, where the pumping strength is equal to the threshold strength, is gamma is 1. So I cannot really use it beyond, I mean, I can write down the theory for gamma bigger than 1, but I will not be able to make sense of it, because then instability will occur, I'll have to treat it. So it's only the values of gamma which are smaller than 1 which are relevant. And you see there's a very non-Gaussian, I mean, you might have thought that this rho of sigma would be some Gaussian, but it's not. It's some very, very broad distribution. And that's because of this thing which is called level repulsion. So level repulsion tells you that eigenvalues do not like to have some narrow distribution. They spread out very widely. That's a very common phenomenon of chaos. In fact, some people say that it's also almost the definition of chaos, level repulsion. So there's this very broad distribution of rows. And what this broad distribution does is that these moments, these higher moments, these higher cumulants, they actually become all very important. It's not that you have just the first or the second, but they're all very, very big. And that now causes this striking effect, and that's now this is actually the final slide. So let me write down what I've plotted here. I could plot the entire distribution, but somehow that contains too much information. So I've just plotted the second moment. So I've just plotted the variance of the number of photons which I count. I've written it in the way in which Einstein wrote it, 1 plus n bar over nu. But of course it won't work, so I have now this thing which I call nu effective. So that's basically the ratio of nu effective over nu. This was Einstein's nu. Right, so nu Einstein was t delta omega 2 pi. This ratio is what I plotted. This is just a definition, right? We just be able to compare it with something which we know how it should be. So if this would be 1, then I would just have the black body limit. That was Einstein's result, valid for a black body. And what you see here is that, well, you can see for absorption that it's a little bit below the black body limit. This is the absorption rate. But if the absorption rate becomes very strong, of course, you approach the black body limit. But that's not fantastically interesting. What's much more interesting is to see what happens for the laser. So for the amplifying medium, you see that this number of degrees of freedom drops and vanishes at the laser threshold. So there is a large excess noise. If this becomes very small, then this becomes, the fluctuations become very big. There's a large excess noise which is not present in a usual laser. And the origin of this large excess noise is level repulsion. It's the fact that this distribution of the sigmas is so very, very broad that you get this very large second moment, this very large excess noise. It's a universal result. It doesn't contain, of course, I've assumed the chaotic system, but once you have assumed the chaotic system, you don't need any material parameters, you don't need any microscopics. This is the final word. Okay, so I think I started 5 minutes late, so I end 5 minutes early, so I think we have a little bit more time left if you want to ask any questions. This is what I have to say. Thank you. Oh, this is a very, very neat trick. You see, all I know is how to do unitary matrices. I have no idea how to incorporate absorption. So you do, or amplification. So first you think about absorption. Well, absorption, I think I might know how to do that, right? So suppose this is the thing I want to study, some chaotic, say some Sine billiards, right? Things come in, things go out, but they're not absorbed. How do you absorb them? Well, insert an opening here and look at the submatrix of a full unitary matrix. So I have a much bigger unitary matrix now because they can get out by here. I have a very big unitary matrix, but I'm only looking at some submatrix. And of course now it's, of course you ask, how do you do that? But that's in mathematics. I say that the full matrix is uniformly distributed in the unitary group, and I want to know the statistics of a submatrix. That's absorption. Now amplification. There's no such thing as a lead which amplifies, right? There's no idea how to do that. But then, fortunately, there is a duality relation. So the scattering matrix of an absorbing system, you see, usually you say S is bigger is 1. But that's actually not entirely true if you have absorption amplification. It's like this, that S at some dielectric constant epsilon times S dagger epsilon prime is 1. And this is great because this tells you how to relate the scattering matrix of an absorbing system to the scattering matrix of an amplifying system. So basically the relation is that the rho of sigma for the absorbing system, let's say for the amplifying system, is 1 over sigma squared rho absorbing 1 over sigma. So this relation here tells you that once you've solved the problem for the absorbing system, you can simply by this duality relation get the answer for the amplifying system. That's how it's done. So there's this trick here, then there's a little bit of math, and then this transformation, and then you're done. Yeah, okay, now you ask more details, give you more details. This is not going to be good, because this somehow is much too strong, this extra lead. So you have to put in here another object, which is like a tunnel barrier. It's basically multiplying, not actually convoluting scattering matrix. You have to put a multiplier here, or a tunnel barrier here, and you have to take the limit at this number of channels here, let's call it M, and the probability to tunnel through this barrier, N times gamma goes, or M goes to infinity, gamma goes to 0, and the product is this fixed little gamma, which is the absorption rate. So that's exactly how you have to do it. So you have to blow up this matrix, but decouple it in this combined limit, and the product is this little number gamma. To actually calculate something in this way is really a tour de force. It's very, very difficult, but conceptually, it's kind of trivial. I know exactly what I have to do. I could perhaps do it on a computer, and you can actually get also some analytical stuff, but unfortunately there's no easy miraculous way out, like some maximum entropy principle some people have tried to figure out. It doesn't exist, but this is the way to do it, and it works.
You showed us this, the variance of the number of photons distribution becomes very large, close to the laser threshold. But then it is interesting to look at higher moments. I assume it's possible to have some asymptotic expression, at least for high order moments.
That's right. So let me first say one thing, just to show that I'm not. When you say the variance, you could always say the variance becomes large simply because the mean becomes large. But that's somehow kind of trivial, right? That's why I write it in this way here. I'm extracting somehow the trivial things that the variance becomes very big and getting just this new. Now, you ask about higher moments. I'm sure I could, and I'll tell you the bad thing about all this business is that, unfortunately, I think it's a fantastic problem, but nobody's interested in it. This is the truth. Nobody's interested in it. So I can tell you that, right? I mean, I love it. And in fact, I've many more problems like this. I mean, you could talk about noise, shot noise. You could talk about a whole bunch of things which you know from mesoscopics and ask them, how do you do them in quantum optics? Nobody wants to try and measure these things. For example, there's this one-third suppression of shot noise, right? Which in our field is a big thing, you know, very big thing. There is an optical analog of that, which is, it's not just some other number. It's really interesting, much bigger effect. If this were being condensed matter, everybody would jump on it, right? But they don't care. They don't want to put disorder. Nobody in quantum optics wants to put disorder in the system. And so I calculate the easy things and then wait with the all these other stuff until somebody perhaps shows some interest. So the answer is I haven't looked at the higher.
Can you just tell us a little more about how that relationship is?
This one here?
No, this one?
No. Well, this just follows from the wave equation. You look at the Helmholtz equation. Right? You look at the Helmholtz equation, which has a complex dielectric constant. And you extract, you write down, for example, the Green's function of this equation and relate the scattering matrix to the Green's function.
One with an epsilon star.
And then you find exactly that. Of course, it would be unitary if epsilon would be real, right? But it's not, since epsilon is complex, it's not unitary, but it still satisfies this duality. And from that you get this. Yes?
So, you've shown us then what happens if you have a very strong AI.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's actually a formula which I haven't written down, but let me write it down. Which is this formula for this new effective. In the most general case, it's the trace of 1 minus SS dagger to the power 2. Probably it's the other way around. It's like this. Divided by the trace of 1 minus SS dagger squared, and there's an n here. Right? Now you see, if you look at this formula, first of all, you notice that this is rigorously smaller or equal to 1. That's good. And you also notice, that if it's a black body, then it's equal to 1, if S is 0. And you also notice that if somehow you can reduce the problem to a one-dimensional scattering problem, say by having some plane mirrors and having actually only one active mode, then the scattering matrix is one-dimensional, and then it's also 1. So you really need a lot, and that's actually the fundamental difference between a random laser and a usual mirror laser. What's the difference? The difference is that in a random laser, you have many overlapping modes. Typically, the number of overlapping modes is, in our language, the dimensionless conductance of the system. So there's a large number of overlapping modes, which all contribute, and you cannot somehow extract them. Whereas if you would use a typical Fabry-Perot, you would operate in the regime where the modes are not overlapping. You have a nice free spectral range. And then you would have essentially a one-dimensional problem. And in a one-dimensional problem, this number is just 1. I mean, then there's no trace to take. It's just... So you need this large number of overlapping modes, and that's really peculiar for a random system. I guess you could perhaps create some integrable cavity which does the same thing, and then you would have problems because you would not be able to calculate anything in a universal way. But if you give me some cavity, I might try to do it. But the key ingredient is overlapping modes. Overlapping modes give you repulsion of eigenvalues, give you a broad distribution of these eigenvalues, and give you a very strong suppression of this ratio.
What is the counterpart of Pontor's shot noise suppression?
Want to know that? It's 1 plus Okay. It's 1 plus 3 halves times the Bose-Einstein function. And now what's the beautiful thing is, okay, the number is not... So for electrons, it would be 1 minus 2 thirds, right? And then there would be some, but then which would be 1 third. It's not just the fact that this number is different. It's the fact that you have this function here. Because if you use this with radiation, which is sent through a linear amplifier, you can get this number F as big as you want. So then what you would find an enhancement of... I mean, the experiment which I've proposed now, I think it would be a fantastic experiment. You take a waveguide, have either one barrier or two barriers. If you do it with one barrier, then you see just Poisson noise. Now you take two barriers, then you see this anomalous non-Poissonian noise, which we know from electrons, from resonant tunneling, but now enhanced by this factor F, which could be 10,000. If I have a linear amplifier, I can have an occupation of a mode, which is 10,000. So just by inserting a second barrier in your system, you would get a 10,000-fold increase in noise. In electronics, people have been very happy to look what happens if you insert an extra barrier and get a factor of 2 reduction in noise. Here you get an effect which is many, many orders of magnitude bigger. And it would be actually kind of difficult to really... I mean, it's not immediately obvious because the second barrier basically reduces the mean by some number, factor of 2, but that's it. But the noise is very strongly enhanced.
So it doesn't have to be an amplifying medium?
No. I'm talking about just an inert dielectric. I mentioned there's nothing in connection with black body radiation. It has nothing to do with black body radiation. It has to do with ordinary photonic noise in all kinds of systems which have analogs and microscopics. There's a whole range of problems which one can think of. Yeah, Leonid.
So what has to
be on noise in optics? So the experiment which I would like people to do, but which has not been done, is just take a waveguide, fill it with these polystyrene balls, send microwave radiation through it, or also light, but microwave is probably easier, and just correlate the output intensity. Just kind of a pretty obvious experiment. There's one group who does these type of experiments for mean quantities. That's the group of Genak at Stony Brook. I've written to him. He says, yeah, he's interested. Perhaps he'll do it. Who knows? I mean, look, it's pretty obvious. Why are we so preoccupied with disorder in condensed matter? It's because it's unavoidable, right? So, of course, for theorists, we all also can make a living out of that. But for an experimentalist, it's basically a nuisance, and it's good that there are theorists who tell them what to do. If you have this nice optical bench with all these nice holes, everything entirely clean, right? There's so many... I mean, why would you want to mess up the thing just because a theorist tells you, I can calculate that, and you'll find some interesting effect? I'm sure this will happen. This will happen, of course, because there are always people looking for new problems. But there's not this instant feedback which you have in say mesoscopics, or where you predict something and if it's doable, someone will do it immediately. Yeah. I've looked a little bit about what happens if you go above the laser threshold, try to answer some of them. I mean, the questions there are not as clean as below the laser threshold, because it's a nonlinear problem of mode competition. And there are some good problems out there. In fact, that's a field, of course, which is much more developed. What I actually like, I mean, it's the same you could say with electron transport, right? I mean, you can be interested in hot electron effects, which are, of course, very important for devices, etc. But, from a fundamental point of view, hot electron effects are not a lot of fun, right? It's much more fun to stay at low bias, low temperatures, and even though that perhaps might not be some useful device, to ask fundamental questions. And that's a little bit my philosophy which has been in this field. I might add, by the way, that this is for me now somehow my background, and I'm trying to now go back into mesoscopics and use what I've learned to study actually electrons. And I think there's some work which might also be related to some of the things which Mamoglu described at the meeting. But basically for this talk, I thought it might be good to just give you a little bit of a background of what can be done if, as a condensed matter theorist, you enter into quantum optics.
Thanks.